We know that words have the power to change attitudes. Take the phrase gray tsunami, for instance. We have been warned for years of a so-called gray tsunami that is about to crash into our society. As lifespans lengthen and birth rates drop, the percentage of Canadians over the age of 65 is growing rapidly. Now, this represents a challenge for hospitals, nursing homes, and families, and it comes with significant costs. Describing this demographic shift as a gray tsunami, with its terrifying image of a monstrous wave poised to break over our heads, is both striking and urgent. That's why we in the media use the term so often. But Andrea Carice, a professor at the University of Toronto, says the tsunami metaphor can have powerful and sometimes tragic consequences in the lives of elderly people. She believes it is emblematic of a larger problem. Dehumanizing attitudes are built into the words we use to talk about aging. As the founder of Canada's first undergraduate program in health humanities, she is using literature and the arts to encourage her students, many of whom want to become doctors, to imagine a different story about what it means to grow old. Andrea Carice has a PhD in English literature for more than 15 years. She worked as a medical researcher in the fields of geriatrics and clinical epidemiology. Her research on narratives about aging won her the prestigious 2014 Pogliani Prize for Literature. She teaches a class called Aging and the Arts at the University of Toronto's Scarborough campus. And Andrea Carice joins me in our Toronto studio this morning. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Sunday edition. You said, told somebody, I think, in an interview that ageism is the last ism that we use.
That's right. It's the last one that seems to be to maybe fly under the radar of acceptability. We often make jokes about seeming or sounding old, looking old, even the way in which we talk about our technology, a phone that's old or out of date. That's something we don't really blink an eye at. But what it does, or what I argue that kind of language does, is reflect deeper attitudes about the ways in which we diminish older age, we're apt to diminish things that we regard as old. And that's what I try to bring attention to in my research and teaching.
So when we use the phrase great tsunami, that's really training us to think about aging and elderly people in a certain way, isn't it?
Absolutely. The reason this metaphor for me is so evocative and something worth really paying close attention to where we see it arise is that it's not just speaking about aging, but particularly an aging population. And as you were saying in your introduction, this is something that we read about on the news, we've encountered in magazines. This is in some ways not news at all that we have a population whose demographic profile is changing in terms of its age.
No, but we in the media, once we get a cliche, we hammer it home, use it all the time.
It's true. And there's all sorts of very good reasons for using that kind of language or finding a phrase that does the work the gray tsunami does. It's urgent. It gives a sense of something we better pay attention to. But importantly, I think it's essential that we don't let that kind of expediency or the way in which that phrase can work so hard in the media to overwhelm the fact that at the end of the day, it's a phrase that's being used to describe people.
Well, then what are the real world consequences of that then? In terms of policy, in terms of how we look at the elderly?
The way in which I've described the impact of the gray tsunami metaphor is the way it helps create a narrative of not just of decline, but of catastrophe around aging. It's very difficult when we have a phrase like gray tsunami circulating in our society to think of aging populations as anything but a disaster. There are no alternative narratives or alternative ways of conceiving of population aging. And what we need to do is register and perhaps even think of alternatives to phrases like the gray tsunami so that that texture of older age can be recognized.
You're not euphemizing old age, are you? I mean, at one point you said that we look at aging as decline, loss, and a burden, isn't it? You're too young to answer that question, but I can put it to you.
Well, I will take your last comment as a compliment. I'm not sure my students would agree that I'm young, but you're absolutely right that we have to be cautious of putting too much of a shine on aging. But I want to draw a really strong distinction between criticizing and critiquing a phrase like gray tsunami and not being able to kind of look at the textured realities of what it means to grow old.
Okay.
Because I see such an issue with this phrase, gray tsunami, that doesn't mean that I think that aging is awesome or that we can all look forward to later lives full of wisdom and calm. This is not the outcome most of us are promised at any point in our lives. But what is really important is that we allow the language we use to talk about aging to open up and reflect the many ways in which we are able to grow old. It might not be as terrible or catastrophic as the gray tsunami suggests, but if that's the only language we have, it's very difficult to imagine otherwise.
I'm trying to think of how an older person, say in the 80s or 90s, would react to that, that being a part of infinitesimal part of a gray tsunami. I mean, that must be depressing.
In the discussions that I've had with older people in the clinical context and outside of it, to be understood as part of a catastrophe, however small, is not an empowering thing.
Well, they're a threat, aren't they? In that phrase is the idea of a threat.
Certainly. And if the only way the language of aging that we have allows us to think about older age as creating a mass of people who are threatening not just the social fabric, but our economic well-being and all of these things that hold our society together, it's a problem and a concerning one because all of a sudden your life is understood as a problem as opposed to your life that is going to be treated better in a clinical scenario or by people outside of a hospital.
I want to talk about your class, Aging and the Arts. How do literature and the arts in general get people to think differently about aging?
One of the ways that I look at the benefits of thinking about aging through the arts, literature especially, is the way that literature or artworks or images have the potential to reflect these individualized experiences of aging. And that's where I think we find that little bit of room to maneuver around or see alternatives to the very powerful narratives of, say, something like a gray tsunami and see alternatives to that.
I'm not sure I'm following you here. You mean that literature can fit us with a greater understanding of aging, or does it have to speak specifically to growing old?
It certainly can. For example, I start my Aging in the Arts course with a discussion of King Lear, a 400-year-old story about an aging king that may or may not be immediate or seem immediately relevant to today's world. And yet, when we look at the way in which King Lear is a portrait to a large extent of elder neglect, of abuse.
Dementia, even.
Possibly dementia. Yeah. Certainly that's been the way the story has been interpreted in recent years. Then all of a sudden, we see the ways in which texts that were written a very long time ago may well help us think about our present moment because they resonate so much. My hope in that Aging in the Arts class is to use a range of texts so that we really draw on the multiple stories that literature can tell about the experience of growing old. So one novel that we read later on in the course is Michael Ignatieff's Scar Tissue, which is a portrait of dementia and caregiving and a really compelling story of artistic and philosophical perspectives on aging juxtaposed or held in contrast to more scientific views of aging. That contrast between maybe a more arts and a more science perspective on aging is something that appeals to my students who are often themselves in the sciences.
At the beginning of the class, I understand that you ask your students what comes to their mind when they hear the word, the very word, aging. How do they respond? What do they tell you?
It's one of my favorite activities because it suggests to me that a course like this, especially using the arts to think about matters of health and illness, that we might actually be on to something. So I ask my students in the very first class to answer privately on a piece of paper, what does it mean to grow old? And that's the first line of a poem by Matthew Arnold published in 1867. What is it to grow old? And so the students write down their answer, and then those who wish to share do. And oftentimes, the first set of answers goes like this. It goes, Alzheimer's, 65, white hair, wrinkles, cataracts, and prune juice has been one that has stayed with me from the beginning. And what happens with that clump of, you know, very short, I won't say thoughtless answers, but they're not particularly nuanced. What's very interesting to me is to accumulate those answers. Say, okay, so this is the portrait. This is what aging is to these young people at the beginning of a course. And then over the course of the 12-week semester, at the end of it, come back to that very question. Say, okay, we asked at the beginning, we asked at the end. Almost invariably, at a student-to-student level, at an individual level, are answers that are far more nuanced, longer, more considered. They reflect the ambiguities of aging. It's not a translation of aging from something terrible and bad into something marvelous and shiny. But what it is at least an acknowledgement that aging might not have been what they believed it to be. And that, to me, is a big outcome of a 12-week course.
These students would be how old?
I would say
early 20s?
Typically, late teens, early 20s, maybe about 19 to 24.
Because at that age, young people rarely think about aging. They are, as we know, immortal. So the whole idea of decline never crosses their mind.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Really?
Actually. What I've learned is that aging and anxieties about growing old are actually very much part of how my students are thinking almost on a day-to-day basis. A lot of my students currently live in multi-generational households.
Right.
And so a grandparent or even an older parent that may be becoming old, may be showing signs of cognitive impairment, or just questions of mobility, health status change. These are things that they're encountering far more often. There is a sense, perhaps, of maybe a little bit of invincibility, or that their aging won't replicate or resemble that exactly. But aging is, I think, very much a part of how my students are thinking about the world and part of the anxieties about living in the world they do.
You were very close to your grandmother. Is that right?
That's right.
But you didn't think of her as an old person. She was just a person of a certain age.
She was certainly old, but I'll qualify it by saying that it wasn't the primary reason or the primary characteristic.
It didn't define her. It wasn't the sole defining
she character. Was that and many other things.
Yeah.
I lived with my grandmother during the summers while I was an undergraduate, while I was beginning my research career. And she was very much a friend throughout my entire life. And I'll say, as were my other grandmothers and grandparents as well. So she has been, for me, an example of how exposure or naturalizing the exposure to people of another generation within your family, but not just within your own family, how that might be a way of, again, thinking differently about what aging means.
I just wonder if your reactions to your grandmother are atypical, because I think a lot of us, when we think of older parents or grandparents, the defining characteristic is they're old. And it's hard to kind of think of other things.
Well, then I think that that is a challenge that that we others need to confront head on. If the only characteristic that you're able to behold about someone is that they are old, or anything else, that they are female, or that they are a person of color,
sure,
it's not a problem or an issue with that person, but in fact an issue of our own perception.
It's our problem.
It's our problem.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Andrea Carice. She is a professor at the University of Toronto. She's also the director of something called SCOPE, which is the Health Humanities Learning Lab. She's with me in Toronto. I wonder if ultimately ageism, and those of us who commit it, stems from our fear of our own mortality.
I think that that is certainly a considerable driver of ageist behavior, or even behavior that attempts to in some way just deny the reality of our own older age. We're not given much instruction in our culture, and I guess I should clarify by saying in Canada, perhaps North America more generally, we're not given much instruction as to how to grow old or how to die or how to encounter the fact that we are mortal beings. We have an increasing interest or maybe increasing discussions of this. The work of Atul Gawande, for example, recent mm-hmm. best-selling memoir, Being Mortal. These are examples where I think that resistance to thinking about mortality, where that might be changing.
A number of your students are doctors in training, or they want to become doctors.
Certainly they want to enter the health professions.
Not necessarily as geriatricians, though.
I mean, not necessarily, although what I have found is that often I have a lot of students that announce that they are interested in care of the elderly or more
really?
Geriatrically oriented forms of health care following the class.
Why is it important, and this is almost a self-answering question, but why is it important for doctors to be trained to think differently about aging?
One of the ways in which I see it as essential that we begin to relearn or at least expand how we think about aging is that if our medical and health professionals are thinking of older persons as a gray tsunami.
Yeah.
As a population catastrophe, then I think it's very difficult to imagine implementing health policies that serve that terrifying population well. If we are imagining older people exclusively as a catastrophe, it's going to be very difficult to create a sense of urgency that they are better served. And so that, for me, is a reason that it's very important for health and medical professionals to be aware of, beginning with the language they use, the way they are conceiving of their older patients.
Okay, but I wonder if the language of the metaphors we use, the tsunami and the crashing and all that, does it make doctors generally, you think, feel resentful of older patients?
There have been studies and certainly data that suggests that ageism is apparent within the medical
yeah.
professions. And there have been important studies done on the ways in which, on the one hand, ageism in the medical field, like other sectors of society, that medicine is not immune to the ageism that affects other sectors of society. One of the ways in which I think we can begin to intervene into that issue is to address the ways in which medical students might be made aware of the potential inclinations towards ageism.
Yeah.
And that's what some of the research that I've done in the past has involved.
But in order for that to happen, it's got to be drawn from the culture at large. And the culture at the moment is that we warehouse our older people out of sight. We want them put away somewhere.
So one of the ways in which ageism becomes more and more entrenched in the medical profession, and I would say health professions more generally, is that health professionals tend to only encounter older people when they are very ill or in the,
yeah,
say, the emergency
right.
room context. But that, of course, does not reflect the much larger experience of aging that doesn't involve being in a hospital, being in an emergency room. But when older people are only encountered by health professionals in the kind of clinical setting, in the acute
yeah.
clinical setting, then that can serve to reinforce the sense that older age means decline as opposed to illness or acute medical events being only part of what it might mean to age.
There are societies that treasure the old, are there not?
I am cautious of those kinds of celebratory narratives because we don't have to look too far to see the ways in which ageism is in some ways a global phenomenon. For example, many of my students that do live in intergenerational households will begin by saying, you know, in my culture, older age is given respect, yeah. is given so on. But what I often find is that through their writings and their reflections that are generated through the course, that oftentimes they do share that, well, in fact, King Lear sounds a lot like how my older relatives are treated. Yeah. Or, gosh, you know, actually, King Lear sounds a lot like the way I've treated my older relatives as well. And so I'm cautious about parsing up the world in terms of sort of who celebrates aging and who denigrates it, because, of course, I think those two things occur often simultaneously.
In any culture, you mean?
Yes.
You use poetry, too.
I do.
How?
So one of the ways I use poetry, poetic language, whether it is speaking about aging or any other topic, is dense. And so it presents us with some very powerfully concentrated images of what it means to grow old. So one of the poems that I like to use is Philip Larkin's The Old Fools, because of the language that it uses around aging. Sounds very ageist, The Old Fools. And yet, without giving the entire poem away, a poem like Larkin's that starts off with a horrific image of life in a nursing home, for example, actually, by the end of the poem, we see the poem turn around and throw that assumption of ageism back at the reader, showing us that, in fact, that it's been the ageist attitudes that the reader has already brought to the poem that the poem wishes to sort of face us with as a mirror. So poetry is very good at condensing that kind of critique and those kinds of images in very imaginative and surprising ways.
And you do this with some caregivers, too, to dispel empathy fatigue, for example.
So I have engaged in what's called narrative training with healthcare professionals. This is actually for a different kind of age group. I've recently concluded, along with my research team, a study that involved pediatric rehabilitation nurses that work with children that have chronic disability, and using poems, comics, very short stories with those nurses in order to bring out some of the stories and the challenges that they face as professionals in their provision of care.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Do you know what's the poem, Yeats, When You Are Old and Full of Sleep?
Yes.
Do you know that? It's a wonderful poem about getting old.
There's also a tattered man upon a stick. Yeats can also provide us with a very succinct statement of the shadow side of aging.
Do you think that we are capable of an attitudinal change, something along those lines, that will lead to a society where the elderly are not seen as a burden, are not seen as a threat? Or is that, Professor, is that utopia?
I would begin by saying the fact that King Lear reads so clearly to us now suggests that the last 400 years have done little to really change the way we, at least in the West, think about the meaning of aging. That said, I don't think I can get up every morning and teach and research the way that I do without a sense that, at least at the individual level, there is the possibility of, for example, using the arts or other resources that are available to us to change how individuals think of aging. If there's some way that we can at least imagine aging as something other than decline, find a small space for that, then it may not be utopia, but it will certainly be better than the kingdom that Lear found himself presiding over.
Great pleasure to meet you on the radio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Andrea Carice. She teaches a class called Aging and the Arts. She's a professor at the University of Toronto at the Scarborough campus. And this morning we were talking about our attitudes toward the elderly and how they should change. You're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM. My name is Michael Enright.